We're moving now into the third part of our course, which addresses the prophets. The first part was the narrative books, which we actually haven't completely finished yet, because we will address Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther at the end of the course. And the middle part of the course, we've addressed the poetic books. And so now we have, in our session here on Obadiah, we're shifting to looking at the prophetic literature. This session will not only be for Obadiah, but we will also talk about the various basics of prophetic literature. So let me go through Obadiah first of all quickly, and then we'll see how it fits into the 17 prophetic books. I'll give you an overview of the prophetic books. Our key word is Edom, because the book of Obadiah is focusing on this nation alone. The people of Edom to the southeast of Israel, modern-day Jordan, on the other side of the Dead Sea. These were the close relatives of Israel. They were the descendants of Esau. Remember that Jacob and Esau were brothers. Jacob became the people of Israel in terms of his descendants. Esau became the people of Edom, or the Edomites. The problem with Edom was they were opposing their brother. They were opposing Judah. There was a recent invasion of the land of Israel. I think it was when Philistines and Arabs came on into Israel, and they looted Jerusalem. And the Edomites were saying, "Yay, go get him, go get him." They were cheering the demise of their brother. Can you imagine doing such a thing? Can you imagine you doing such a thing? Don't you want your brother, if you have a brother or your sister, to succeed? But if you have hatred toward your brother or your sister, and you see that the person being persecuted, and then you end up cheering about it, that's quite a despicable sort of thing, isn't it? And that's what the Edomites had done, and so God raised up Obadiah to write in regard to them that God was going to destroy Edom, that God was going to judge Edom, not only for that, but for other things as well. So in terms of our key verse, I have two of them here. One is relating to Edom, the other is relating to Israel. The judgment is on Edom. This is what God said to them. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, that's talking about the people of Judah, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. Verse 10. But then you go to the very last verse of this very short book, the shortest of all the prophetic books, verse 21. There's blessing on Israel. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion, he's talking about Jerusalem, to govern the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. And that's how the book of Obadiah ends. He's saying, you Edomites should never have cheered at the demise of your brother. There's going to be a reversal here. You are going to be the one who is destroyed, and Israel's actually going to possess your territory in the days ahead. The kingdom will be the Lord's at that time. And so this gives us two of the key aspects of the book of Obadiah that I'm dividing in half, one from the first half and one from the second half. In terms of how this is looking at the kingdom idea as universal king, God will judge Edom and all nations who oppose him. Edom actually ends up a picture of all the nations we find in the prophetic literature. Over and over, when God's talking about judging Edom in what we'll study as the day of the Lord, he's actually talking about the nations as a whole. The destructions of both Edom in the near future, in my summary statement here, and all nations in the day of the Lord, these are two destructions, a small and a large, they'll come as God's judgment for their opposing Judah. But Judah can be comforted with the promise of blessing due to God's protection in the land covenant. Remember, God had told Abraham that he would give him that land from the Wadi of Egypt, the seasonal stream in the Sinai Desert, all the way up to the Euphrates River, that land would be the possession of Israel forever. Genesis 17, verse 8. It's said to be forever. Genesis 15, verse 18, he specifies those borders. And those borders appear in this book as well. That was part of the covenant we would call the land covenant. Older scholars used to call this the Palestinian covenant. But now that there has become this people, amalgamation of many, many peoples that are calling themselves the Palestinians, it becomes a very, very confusing concept to call it the Palestinian covenant because it doesn't relate to the Palestinians. It relates to Israel, living in the land of Israel. So Christ's return will enact the land covenant with its expanded land boundaries. You want to see what those boundaries are? They're right here in the book of Obadiah, verses 17 to 21. And we'll see them in a minute. After God judges Edom for oppressing his covenant people, this is saying that the Edomites were not part of the covenant people. God didn't give a land covenant to them, but he did to Israel. And what God promises, God will fulfill. And so he says deliverance will come for Zion. Mentions that twice, verses 17 and 21, where we see the redemption theme showing up here. It'll come through the destruction of this deliverance for Judah will come through the destruction of Edom and other Gentiles that fight against God's people. The issue is not whether that you're just Gentiles and that God is just so pro-Israel that he hates all the Gentiles. We know now that more than 99% of all the believers in the world are Gentiles. So God certainly doesn't hate Gentiles. If it does, he hates 99% of us, right? It's just saying that these people who refuse to acknowledge that God has his hand on this chosen nation of Israel will be judged by God for that. And we see the Messiah theme here as well. Christ will judge not only Edom, but he will judge all nations. Because verses 15 and 16 are finding their fulfillment in the day of the Lord when Jesus actually comes back and renders his judgment upon those nations opposing him, opposing the Lord. And he will do that before he reigns with other believers. Because the last verse says, and deliverers will inhabit the place of Zion, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. So what we find in this book is Edom's destruction. And the reason why their destruction? They will be destroyed for opposing Judah. Edom's destruction for opposing Judah. The first 14 verses highlight the destruction of this nation, the judgment on Edom. And the last verses give us the other side of it. Looking at the short end, you might say, the near end, to when you get to verses 15 to 21, we get to the longer future, the blessing on Judah. I see what I've done here. So you see the two parts? Edom's destruction and then the day of the Lord. Or proud Esau defeats defenseless Jacob in the first part, and then the latter part, powerful Jacob defeats humbled Esau. So the first part is past, and it's, you might say, you could write there, I guess, narrow or local, because it's relating only to Edom. The latter part, the last six verses, seven verses of the book, 15 to 21, widens significantly so that we're talking about all nations. And breaking these down a little bit further, after you have the author, there's the judgment. The humbling is prophesied for the Edomites in verses 1 to 9. And then the reason for that humbling is because of the injustices that Edom had done to Israel. The judgment is for injustices. But then there's a major shift in verse 15 to the day of the Lord is upon all nations, the author says. And that didn't happen during Edom's time. And because if it did, then God didn't fulfill the second part of it, where it says that all these deliverers will be on Zion and the kingdom will be the Lord's. That certainly has not been the case in the land of Israel. Israel hasn't even had the land but for 70 years now. So this is looking to, I think, a future fulfillment. So I call it judgment on modern enemies and blessing on modern Israel. Right? So in Huddleston's depiction of it, he just says Esau. You could just say Edom. For four sections of the book, Edom's doom is prophesied. And then the sins of the Edomites is a good depiction of verses 10 to 14. And the accountability of all nations. He sees the depiction here as widening to refer to the whole world. And then the ultimate restoration of Israel. Now, what was the major problem with these Edomites? Why would they go join their enemies and trying to destroy the people of Israel? It was because of their pride. So when I depict the application of this book, I think the best way to do it is to say, be humble. Obadiah is telling us to be people who are not characterized by pride. You know, Christians ought to be the humblest people around. And it's not that way oftentimes, but it should be. They should be able to look to the future and see that there is... God is going to humble all people who exalt themselves before Him. The Edomites were just one group that was filled with pride. And those who are filled with pride will be humbled. Those who humble themselves, God will honor. Yeah. If you look at the first few verses of the book, you'll see what they are prideful about. They had a unique place geographically. They were able to live high in the rocks. Look at the first verse. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. We've heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise and let us go against her for battle. That should get these people afraid. What? You mean the nations are coming against us? Yep. God says, see, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. Now, this aerial picture of Edom makes them look quite small, doesn't it? But they didn't have any planes back then. They didn't have any aerial shots. They thought of themselves from their own standpoint as being quite quite high. In fact, the Edomites lived in the area, part of which of their kingdom was a city called Petra. Petra means rock. And they actually carved their houses out of the rock. I hope if you ever take a trip to Israel, you'll have a one-day extension into Jordan and go down to the city of Petra. It's a fascinating, fascinating city. One of the most fascinating I've ever been to. Because the people just got their chisels and they carved their houses right out of the stone walls in their city. And the Lord describes the reason for their destruction in verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? You see, because they lived up higher than everybody else, they had a haughty spirit. They thought of themselves as being higher than others. And isn't the same true today? Where do we put the penthouse? in a fancy building. It's not in the basement, right? Now, I'm not saying the person who lives up in the penthouse way up at the top is necessarily the proudest, but certainly has the most money and the most opportunity for pride. Generally, those who are living up at the top are at what we call the top of the food chain, you know? Everybody else has to serve these, the millionaires and the billionaires. But there are many who actually are living, who have a lot more money than you and I do, but are not filled with pride. God can do that. God can work in our hearts. So it doesn't have to be that way. But these people had a lot of money. And you know how they had money? They had there in the place of Esau, the Edomites, this is where the spice trade went through. The spices that were coming from India, they went across the land through the land of Edom, and they came very close to Petra. In fact, the spices that came from from India, by the time they went through Petra and ended up at the Mediterranean coast, they cost 7 times as much. Guess where all the profit went?
To these people who protected all the caravans along the way.
Right? You know what I mean? You know what protecting the caravans means? You get paid enormous amount of money not to rob these people. You know? It sort of reminds me years ago when I was a missionary in the Philippines. And I parked my car up at a restaurant. And a little boy about 5 years old came out to me. And he said, "Oh, Joe, hey Joe." That they call Americans Joe there, you know, like G.I. Joe, you know. So every white guy is like me, is Joe, you know. He's like, "Hey Joe, I protect your car, 1 peso." And I look at the little 5-year-old boy and I go, "Yeah, really? You're going to protect my car? I mean, seriously, if the bad guys come, you're going to fight them off, right?" But I realized he had another peso in his pocket. And my friends had told me, if you don't pay him the peso, he'll use the peso that he does have, and he'll scratch from the end of the car all the way up to the front of the car. Now, to repair that scratch costs more than a peso. And so I thought, yeah, I've got a peso for this 5-year-old. That was about 1/7 of a dollar back then, even less now. Yeah, I got enough money to pay this little boy, so he'll protect my car. This is what the Edomites did. They said, "Yeah, we got the spices. The spices come on through this area. We'll protect your caravan." And boy, did they protect that caravan, but not for free. And so they made a lot of money, and they lived up in the heights. And as a result, they became a very, very proud people. The National Geographic has actually done 3 specials, I believe, in the last 100 years on Petra, starting from 1907. And these are phenomenal pictures of Bedouin living up in this ancient city of stone. Looking on down in it, you can see that they've carved into the rock several of their buildings. And of course, we're looking at an aerial picture taken by a helicopter or a drone or a plane. But down on the ground, the only way to get on into Petra was what was called the seek. It was about a 1-kilometer fissure in the rock that was not any wider than this classroom. In other words, I mean, in fact, sideways in the classroom. And for an army to go on in and try to conquer Petra, they would have to get their army through this very, very narrow area in to fight against the Edomites. And the Edomites were up above with arrows, with stones, with boiling oil, with all kinds of stuff trying to, protect their place. And no army was able to actually go on in and to defeat them. And so they ended up being very proud about being... having such a defensible position and having all this money. And this only entrance into Petra also had a water course in it, where water was brought through this little carving in the stone straight on into the city. So they had water, and these things were buried for centuries until the late 1800s, where an archaeologist actually discovered Petra, where it was, and then they had to dig down all the way through the whole city because it had been covered by 20 centuries of sand. But you can go there now. You don't have to do any of the digging. The other people have already done all the digging for you. And it's quite amazing to go through the Sikh and get to the end of it, and you can see what seems kind of strange. So it looks like columns ahead of you, and then it opens all the way up to the treasury, which was carved right out of the stone. And the inside of the treasury is not any larger, really, than maybe this size of this classroom. But that's all carved out of stone, too, you know? And Bedouin from the top can look down at a tour group down below there looking at it. And their engineers from the later Edomites, after the Edomites, were the Nabataeans. They ingeniously collected rain by carving into the stone so that the little bit of rain that did come would actually be collected inside cisterns inside the hill. So they had water, even though they only had 6 inches of rain, you know, a year. They had water brought in the city, and these people ended up becoming very, very powerful. They even carved some of their places for tombs. And Petra is an absolutely fascinating place. So, the pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks. And you say, who's going to bring me down? Well, you know, God actually answers that question. God says, though you soar like an eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. You think you're up high? How about if you go all the way to the stars? I'm still going to bring you down. You know? The same thing can happen to anybody today, you know, who seeks to exalt himself. God has his way of exalting ancient and modern kings. He says, if thieves came at night and robbed you, what a disaster awaits you. They would not take everything. Those who harvest grapes and always leave a few, they always leave a few for the poor, but your enemies will wipe you out completely. And so these people are, you know, there's really, really very, very perilous times actually coming for them. That's what he says in the first part, and I don't have the time to get to give you all of the verses, but God definitely will judge the proud, but God also blesses the humble. And we will see in this second part, that's called the Day of the Lord, that the Lord promises to bless his people. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. Verse 15 says, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. Now, you see how he's really broadening here? He's not talking about the Edomites. He's talking about some time period, yet future, where God is going to judge all of the nations. And we'll have whole sessions on this whole concept of the day of the Lord later on in Zephaniah and in Joel. But at this point, he just says, just as you swallowed up my people on my holy mountain, so you and the surrounding nations will swallow the punishment I pour out on you. Yes, I'll pour out on you. Yes, all you nations will drink and stagger and disappear from history. He's saying, basically, there's going to be a reversal. The first 14 verses talk about how Edom had triumphed over Israel. God is going to judge them for that. And the latter seven verses, talk about Israel will be triumphing over Edom. You know how you approach a summit, and when you're, I don't know if you've hiked in mountains very much. My sons and my wife and I, we love to hike in the mountains. When we go back to the States, we always take a hike up in the mountains. And it's an interesting thing because you can tend to think that you're just going on up, you're going straight on up to a summit. It's as if, like the prophet was looking to the future and he was just seeing the land go up and up. The prophets are often looking ahead to the exile and the return. They may actually be looking farther to Christ's coming, first coming to suffer, second coming to reign. And sometimes the prophets are actually looking to the new heavens and the new earth. But as they look, I think God just allowed the prophets to be able to look in it. They didn't necessarily see all the valleys. If you're up high, or if you're in an airplane, you can see the valleys quite clearly. I love being in planes and looking on down and seeing a perspective that people can't see. He's saying, what Obadiah is actually seeing is he's looking to the future, and he sees beyond actually the first coming of Christ in the church age. He's looking at what we call the day of the Lord at the second advent, which is a time of God punishing or getting the attention of Israel through a very difficult time called the tribulation, and then following that with a longer period of time that we would call the millennium. We don't have these terms, tribulation and millennium, in the Old Testament prophets. We don't even know how long this great period of blessing is from the Old Testament itself. We just know that there's this, like the last verse of Obadiah says, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. You get this idea that this is a long kingdom, but he doesn't say how long it's going to be. We don't find until we get to Revelation chapter 20 that this is a 1,000 years. And we'll study these other passages from Zechariah and Ezekiel, etc., as we move along. But he's looking to this future period when Messiah comes. From our perspective, we know that there's a huge valley here and that the Lord Jesus is actually coming twice. I don't think Obadiah saw that. But he says, but Jerusalem, verse 17, will become a refuge for those who escape. It'll be a holy place. And the people of Israel will come back to reclaim their inheritance. The people of Israel will be a raging fire, and Edom will be a field of dry stubble. The descendants of Joseph will be a flame roaring across the field, devouring everything. There'll be no survivors in Edom. I, the Lord, have spoken. Which really raises this big question. Is there a future for national Israel? And we have many different perspectives on this whole subject. You've got two sons coming from antiquity, Ishmael and Isaac, two sons of Abraham. We know that the sons of Ishmael became the Arabic peoples. We know the sons of Isaac became the Jewish people. And all through the centuries, there has been conflict between them. There's a lot of conflict even among the people of Ishmael, among themselves. The question, though, is which son is God saying that he has this promise, this promise of blessing to? He specifically says, take your only son, Isaac, whom you love, Genesis 22. That's a strange saying, isn't it, from God? God knew that he had two sons, but God says, take your son, your only son. Why would God say that? He knew that Ishmael was 14 years older than Isaac. Well, Isaac follows whom you love to heighten the effect. The idea is he's the son of the promise. And God is saying, I want you to take that son who will receive the promise. Now, Ishmael also is going to be blessed. God says, Genesis 17:20, as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I've blessed him and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I'll establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. God's distinguishing between his land covenant to Israel as opposed to the many other blessings he's going to give the Arabs. Now, let me ask you this question. Who do you think God blessed more? Did God bless the descendants of Ishmael more? Or did he bless the descendants of Isaac more? What do you think? Who has the greater influence? Who has more land? When you think about the Middle East, think about it. The descendants of Ishmael occupy North Africa, pretty much all of the Middle East, and into Iran. The descendants of Isaac have one little sliver of land. There's 80 times as much land occupied by the descendants of Ishmael as there is by the people of Isaac. Do you think God's been unfair with the descendants of Ishmael? Has God been unfair to give them 80 times more land? I put it that way, you kind of go, well, that doesn't sound too unfair to me, does it? Why is there such an enormous difference? Why is the Arab world just humongous compared to the land of Israel? Why does Muhammad have so much land compared to Isaac? The land of Israel is not very large. If you put it in Australia, it's just a little sliver. It's, I don't know, 1/20th the size of France. Where I come in California, it's the width of California. So the length of California goes some almost 1,000 miles. It is relationship to Singapore. Is Israel bigger or smaller? It's bigger. Just to let you know, God blesses little things, okay? The width of Israel and the width of Singapore are about the same, but you're right. Israel stretches far greater to the north and the south than Israel. Does that seem fair? Why does God give some countries so much more land than Israel? The Israelites were given more land and ultimately more wealth than the Israelites. The Ishmaelites were given more land and ultimately more wealth than the Israelites. Hal Lindsey says in his book, The Everlasting Hatred. This is true in their past history, not to mention the vast oil wealth of modern times. And spiritual salvation has always been open to the Ishmaelites. But God's covenant, which concerned his spiritual promises, was only for Isaac and his descendants. The physical blessings promised to Isaac were to facilitate God's spiritual call for the nation that would come from him. I'll tell you, God loves the descendants of Ishmael. In fact, there are many more descendants of Ishmael, I'm talking about Muslims, who have entrusted Christ today than there are Jews. Even though we have a lot more evangelistic effort for Jews than we do for Muslims, more Muslims have responded. Some of you here are from Indonesia. Indonesia has been the largest Muslim nation in the world and yet has seen more people trust Christ than I think any time in history. It's a phenomenal thing to see. Even the little land that they have, the descendants of Isaac, that land has been argued over. And some of the descendants of Ishmael are seeking to take among that 1/80th of the Middle East. And yet God says in Genesis 15:18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. And there's problems there with Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. But what we find here is that God promises in the book of Obadiah that people from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau. All right, so the Negev is the southern part of Israel. They're going to move on over to Esau. That's what God says is going to happen in the future. And people from the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. And they will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria. And Benjamin will possess Gilead, going way up to the north. This company of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad will possess the towns of the Negev. Where in the world is Sepharad? We don't really know. Some people say it's Spain. Others say it's Media over in the land of Iran today. Others say it's over in Libya. Others say Asia Minor. I don't know where Sepharad is. But he does say the people of Sepharad will possess the Negev, that desert land of Israel, which is not continuing to be desert because Israel keeps piping water in there and they're making it flourish, actually. But it says, the exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad will possess the towns in the Negev. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. What God is saying here is that this book of Obadiah is not just about Edom. It is about all the nations. It is about what God is... The judgment that Esau was going to experience is just a little foretaste of what God is actually going to do in the days ahead. I try to diagram all this on page 337 in the Kingdom and Covenants timeline. This is a really involved chart. It's probably too much. I'm breaking most of the rules of PowerPoint here by putting too much on one slide. But at least you can see the whole picture here where the Abrahamic covenant with the land, the seed, and the blessing, these aspects are all moving toward a partial fulfillment now between the first and the second comings of Christ and a full and complete fulfillment later on in the Messianic kingdom, both in its millennial and its eternal phases. That's the covenant aspect, the kingdom idea you find at the top here, where God's kingdom rule that was given to man at the beginning, God is working through all creation and all periods so that he would restore that kingdom rule at the end. We've talked about that before. But as it relates to the issue of pride, you notice in the word pride, the very center letter is I. That's the point about pride. I am more important than anybody else. That's what a proud person says and does. That's what the Edomites did. They didn't have any concern even for their brothers, let alone their enemies. The descendants of Jacob were their brothers. The main idea here in Obadiah is God humbles the proud, but exalts the humble. And this book is really a call to humility. We see several calls to humility here. God judges the prideful who try to destroy his people. In fact, he says, God will do unto you as you have done unto others. I don't call that the golden rule. I call that the iron rule. The golden rule is positive. The iron rule is God's judgment. How does he judge us? He uses the same standard we use for others. Wow. And then the eventual and final fate of Edom is the fate of all the wicked. It's death. And so what we find in this short prophecy here is a picture of what God's going to do in the days ahead. We find the same idea in other places like Isaiah 2. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that are exalted. And they'll be humbled. Or Matthew 23, for whoever exalts himself will be humbled, And whoever humbles himself will be exalted. This is God's plan, as we see in James 4:6. But he gives us more grace. That's why the scriptures say, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. I like what Ken Blanchard says. Humility doesn't mean you think less of yourself. It means you think of yourself less. It doesn't mean you depreciate yourself so that you're dirt and scum. Because you're not dirt and scum. You're valuable in the eyes of God. But so are other people. And if we have genuine humility, we see the value that other people have, and we think of ourselves less. So in what area of your life do you need to curb pride? I dare say that every one of us has an area like that that we need to curb. Maybe it's pride of our academics, pride of the way we look, pride of the fact that we have more money than others. I don't know. But God certainly wants us to be humble people. And we have every right and responsibility to be humble. And I'll tell you, the more education you get, the more money you get, the more comfort you get, the easier it is to be prideful. And this is something we need to continually bring back before the Lord. We have a few minutes, so let me go jump over to slide 14 and just show you that the prophets that we're going to be studying actually cover the whole, they're all over the place. Hosea and Amos up in the north, and then we're going to look at Jonah and Nahum that are relating to Assyria. We will, as we have just done, Obadiah relates to Edom. What was he saying about Edom? They were bad, okay? So he said, oh, bad. You get it? They're, oh, bad. So bad for you to be taking advantage of your brother. That's what Obadiah was saying. Ezekiel and Daniel, we'll see they're relating to Babylon and Persia outside the land. But in the land of Judah, we'll find that there are many, many. Most of the prophets are actually relating to the southern nation of Judah. And if you go to page 445, you'll see how to kind of put them together. If you think of the United Kingdom having S-O-S, the David there, the D in David almost looks like an O, right? So think of S-O-S, not S-D-S, Saul, David, Solomon. It'll help you remember the kings of the United Kingdom. Of course, we know that it's split, and the pre-exile period had many prophets in it. To remember those who ministered to the north, think of Hosea and Amos, okay? That's what Israel was saying about God. We don't need to follow God. What God do we... Why do we need to follow... Why do we need to be so limited to one God? And so they worship the idols of all the nations. And so, in some of them, God actually took these prophets and he brought them... in Jonah's case, he brought them to Assyria. In Nahum's case, he had him stay in the land of Israel and prophesy about Assyria. But we put both of them with Assyria. Do you notice what both of those have in common in their names? It's not Ha, but it's Nah. Nah. Jonah. Nahum. Yeah, that'll help you remember. The Ha guys and the Nah guys. Of course, Obadiah said the people of Edom were bad. So, oh, bad. So God raised up a prophet to talk about how, oh, bad these people were. Then God brought the people away into exile. And he spoke to them there in exile. And while they were in exile, he raised up two prophets who have the letters IE for in exile in their name. Isn't that convenient? And you thought God didn't love you, right? Ezekiel, Daniel. IE, IEL actually, in exile. We'll help you remember the two prophets that were speaking while in exile. The people were brought back to the land. We'll end the course this way with the Jews in Jerusalem. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi will be the last of the prophets. I don't know how to think about that, but Ha-ze-ma is the best I can do. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So those are the final Old Testament books. But there's 17 total, right? So we're missing the big group of them, the pre-exilic prophets to Judah. Haggai, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Joel, Micah, Zephaniah, and Lamentations. The other ones are pretty easy, right, to remember. But these guys, that is a hard one to remember. You got two J's in the middle. But maybe if we just thought of H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, that would be helpful. And it's often very helpful to make it into a song. All right, so you ready to sing with me? H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. Sing with me. H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. Keep singing. H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. Now, big finish. H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. Da-da-da-dum-dum. Now, I know you're going to have a very difficult time remembering H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, because H-I-J-J-M-Z-L is difficult to remember. But if H-I-J-J-M-Z-L is hard to remember, then repeating H-I-J-J-M-Z-L could be helpful to remember H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, don't you think? I don't know. You're going to just be forgetting H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. As we move on the rest of the day, later on you're going to say, what was that H-I-J-J-M-Z-L thing? I can't remember that H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. What was it? H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. What did H-I-J-J-M-Z-L stand for? And anyway, since you're going to forget H-I-J-J-M-Z-L, I thought maybe I should repeat H-I-J-J-M-Z-L. And so now, what you actually can do, I believe, is you can turn the page to the next page. It's all blank, and I bet you could fill it all in, right? Without looking at the other page. And so I want you to do that before you do anything else, and we'll move on, in our case, to chapel.